What is up, friends? Welcome back to the New Evangelicals podcast. Okay, on this episode, I'm doing something a little bit different. I'm actually pulling out an interview that I did on my previous podcast, the Coffee Theology and Jesus podcast, because we've never released this interview before and it needs to be heard. On this interview, we had the chance to bring on Dr. Michael Heiser on the show. Now, if you don't know who he is, let me just tell you something right now. This guy is a heavyweight in the world of academia. He is a heavyweight when it comes to Hebrew cosmology. His work on the what's called the Divine Council in the Bible is going to blow your mind. So let me just put it this way. If you are not familiar with the Divine Council or some of the more cosmological perspectives of the Bible, you're in for a real treat on this episode because Dr. Heiser is the go-to guy on this. He also runs a podcast called The Naked Bible, which has hundreds of thousands of downloads each week. So it was a real privilege and a real honor to have him on the show. So what I did was I took the interview and I threw it in this format. So you're going to hear my buddy Rob, who was one of my co-hosts on this podcast, also chime in. And the audio quality isn't great. We did it over Zoom at the time. I wasn't recording into GarageBand directly, but it will suffice for the sake of, you know, this interview. So that being said, I just want to say, buckle up. This is a heavy theological episode that might leave you scratching your head. There's all different things that he says that will make you go, wait, what? I need more information. So please make sure you check out Dr. Heiser's work. It's on YouTube. It's on Instagram. It's everywhere. Just buckle up, friends. We're going into the deep end of theology today. One more thing before I play the interview, I just want to say to all of the subscribers on this podcast, thank you for subscribing. If you are listening to this episode, can you please give us a rating and a review? That would just be immensely helpful for our show to come up in the rankings on iTunes and on Spotify. It takes literally 5 seconds to hit 5 stars and submit and you're done. It would be a huge help to us. So if you could do that, that would be great. All right, without further ado, here is the interview with my buddy Rob of us talking to Dr. Heiser. I hope you enjoy the episode. Mike, thank you so much for coming on the Coffee Theology and Jesus podcast. It is honestly, it's a treat to have you on the show. So thank you for making time to come on.
Yeah, you bet. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. I like asking all of our guests, and Rob's on this with me, which is great, but we like asking our guests just to give us the 5-minute overview of who they are, how they kind of got to where they are, and what they like to talk about. So the floor is yours.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my present lofty title is the executive director of the Awakening School of Theology and Ministry. That's in Jacksonville, Florida. Okay. And in you know, the translation of that is, I'm finding myself in a place I never thought I would find myself. I'm in the midst of a megachurch network, which Mike and megachurch are like antonyms. I told the leadership here, I'm the antidote to megachurch. but they wanted to hire me, you know.
Great.
So I'm in the midst of and the reason is they have made very intentional decisions about shifting from an attractional model, which is a term I learned after I got here. I understand it now. But to shift from sort of being an event-based, attractional model-based church to a church that provides content, not only for its network, but internationally.
Wow.
And they wanted a significant focus of that to be my content. So that's why we moved it. Before that, I was at Logos Bible Software, otherwise known, you know, today as Faith Life. That's the corporate name, for almost 15 years, which was a job I loved. You know, I got to meet and work with scholars all over the world and not grade papers. it was great. But the last 3 or 4 years of that, I was writing. You know, it's where Unseen Realm was born, you know, 5 years ago now. And then I just wrote some other things, but initially I was the academic editor, which I never really edited anything. That was better than a language geek, you know. So, you know, that's what I've done for the last, 15 or so years. I've taught, biblical studies for 20 years, green campuses, online. My PhD is in Hebrew Bible and Semitic languages. Mm. So lots of dead languages, which I enjoyed. I love scripture. I love languages. I love biblical theology. Before I became a believer in high school, I like to tell people I was just interested in anything old and weird. So like when I came to the Lord and discovered what the Bible was, it's like, man, this is the sweet spot right here.
Old and weird. Old and
weird. So that's kind of what I am. I've been involved in what we would call the fringe community for 20 years. What floats my boat is that I try to take in biblical studies and really in these fringe areas too, things like ancient astronauts, and whatnot. I try to take peer-reviewed scholarly research and make it decipherable to people, both exposing it to people and then trying to communicate the nuggets from it that will matter. Okay. That matter for interpretation, for clear thinking. That's really what I try to do. And on my podcast, Naked Bible Podcast, I try to find other scholars who are doing intentional things for the church. Mm. I mean, most of the time, I do produce content for the podcast, but we have interviews, and when I find a scholar that's doing something intentional for the church, I like to expose my audience to them. Mm. And most of my audience is lay people. Yeah. We've had 7 million downloads.
Wow.
Easily 100,000 downloads per episode, in a month. There are a lot of people out there who just care, and they are not being fed in church. And so I'm putting that flag up.
Yeah.
Okay. This is where you come. And I will do my best to help other people who are trying to do the same thing, like the Bible Project. We've done some joint things there.
Yeah.
They do wonderful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I try to do. That's what I feel I should, really the reason I'm here is to produce content in various forms for anybody who cares.
Yeah.
And to help people think better about scripture and better about just ancient stuff, in general. Just, let's think a little bit better about primary sources. Let's not use logical fallacies. They're really not good. They're entertaining, but they're not good. And just try to do better. Try to do better.
I think one of our focuses recently, we've had Dr. Randy Richards on, and it is that exactly what you're saying. People are interested, but they have this lens that they've been given from the American church model that puts on a cultural perspective that just isn't faithful to the original text.
I really try to be sympathetic. Mm-hmm. It may not sound like it, and I can be pretty brutal. And I don't mind doing that. But I also want to let people know that, I get the difficulty of the pastoral job. I get it. Mm-hmm. Pastors have people for 20, 30 minutes a week. So, okay, what is it this week? Is it content? Is it the pep talk or the crisis of the week? Okay, this is what we have. What are we going to do? In a perfect world, it's content and a little bit of a pep talk, that, but a lot of cases that just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And the MDiv, the training for pastors is, and this isn't a bad thing. It's a sensible thing. The training for pastors is a mile wide and an inch deep.
Mm.
That's what an MDiv is. It's supposed to be that. Mm. But what's supposed to happen on the other end is the pastor is supposed to continue using the tools and the techniques that they learn in seminary to study, okay, right, and provide content for people. But that typically isn't what happens for some good reasons. I mean, when I say good, I mean like understandable reasons.
Mm.
There's just so much time during a week, but then there's just some lazy reasons too and some ineptitude reasons, I just get it. They're in a tough spot. But I also think that on the negative side, that pastors routinely underestimate both the aptitude of the people in church and their appetite for content.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is routinely underestimated.
Yeah.
And it does damage. It does damage because your people, if you can't answer their questions, they either think you don't have an answer, you're too lazy to give them an answer, or you're one of those people. That's not an important question. It's peripheral to whatever we're doing here, perpetuating our subculture, really.
Right.
You know, so what are they going to do? They're not going to take your words like it's spoken ex cathedra in Protestant circles, okay? You know, we don't have Protestant popes and pulpit popes here. They're going to go to the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And now you've really done it. now you have driven them to the slough of despond, to the pit of despair, and just honestly to crazy town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's Middle Earth. I mean, my metaphor is Middle Earth.
That's true.
You know,
yeah.
I have a whole thing about Christian Middle Earth, you know, and how that is a wonderfully explanatory metaphor for what really goes on in the world of believing Christianity. It's Christian Middle Earth.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what we have.
Yeah.
That's the church.
Yes. Yes. I mean, you're really spot on in so many ways. Rob and I have talked about this on the podcast and behind the scenes. I even started a new Instagram account called The New Evangelicals, trying to have conversations that I feel like the church isn't having in my layman self. You know, it's nothing that's really well done, but it's at least a shot. I do think you bring up a great point, though, and I'm sure you know this. You know, right now, the big thing for a lot of people my age, a millennial, is this idea of, you know, deconstructing, you know, like, oh my gosh, like, you know, what I believed. And the question now is, what are we reconstructing to? That's the new question. And for me, it has been people like, I mean, really the Bible Project was the catalyst for me of discovering their podcast and going, I've been looking for people like this to take ideas I know are so beyond me and give them to me in like straight talk. And it honestly, it's not only saved my faith, it made me more passionate about the Bible and what God's doing than anything in my 32 years of church have ever done. And that's just
it's
a reality.
It's amazing how, I mean, and the Bible Project does this visually, but for me as a listener to Tim is a literary guy. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm kind of a nuts and bolts philology, biblical theology guy. He's a literary guy. And he'll turn that, you know, to serving biblical theology, which is really, really important. So they don't just provide kind of visual, feasty, shallow things. They have depth on the Bible Project. They really do. But the wonderful thing is because of the way they do it, they stick to the meta narrative. Mm-hmm. And it's awesome how if you just stick to the story, how appealing and fascinating Scripture becomes, as opposed to, well, here's a Bible passage. I'm going to produce four bullet points out of it. Throw in a poem, you know, and here's your to-do list. You know,
you're absolutely right.
There's a reason why it was given to us in terms of just the percentage of content of the Bible. So much of it is story.
Yes.
They're intelligent, supernatural, you know, God reasons for producing it that way. And they have tapped into that, you know, and it's what I've tried to do in Unseen Realm. You know, our audiences overlap a little bit, but you know, I'm shooting in one direction, they're shooting in another. And I look for people trying to do that.
Yeah.
And I didn't even do it intentionally. It was like something like 3 years down the road, I realized what this really is meta narrative stuff. Like how did I wind up here?
But
it makes so much sense when you can look back on it and put the focus there.
Right.
You know, it wasn't until we were talking with Dr. John Walton and he brought up, you know, we have the general list of spiritual gifts that are in Scripture. He's like, I honestly believe that biblical studies, someone that is dedicated to language and linguistics, and someone that is dedicated to doctoral studies, that is also a spiritual gift. Like not everybody is built for that. And so from that interview, I gained an appreciation for him, for people like yourself and the work that you do on your podcast, and greater for the Bible Project, because it's things that we don't generally think about, but it's 100%.
You realize what you just did there. you talked about spiritual gifts in the context of providence. How dare you? I mean, no, it reflects this notion that, well, I have this list in the Bible that must be exhaustive.
Right.
Or like other lists that are
right. You know? Right. So I do, while we have you here, I want to hop into one of the big topics, if you don't mind, because I feel like everything you've said already, I'm like, we can park there forever. I'm so passionate about it. Obviously,
which,
so
which mind grenade do we want to
drop? I know. Exactly. So here's the one I want to drop. This is the one that really got me to go, oh my God, I had no idea this was here. So one of the first episodes, and I referenced the Bible Project a lot because they really were so influential, but one of their first series I heard was this series called God or Gods. It was just this idea of like, Tim goes on the show, my first time ever hearing him, and he kind of, you know, Tim is very gentle. He nudges you gently. Now, I'm not that way. I'm like, here's the truth. Boom, you know? But Tim is not that way. He's patient. And he presented this idea that the term...
And he smiles while he's doing it.
And he smiles. I'm more like you where I can be very brutal, you know? But anyway, so the idea he presents is that in the Bible, especially, you know, in the Old Testament often, this idea of God, we kind of see it as like Yahweh God, but the idea Elohim doesn't always mean that. And he kind of presents this idea of there could be other lowercase gods in the Bible. And to me, I'm like, oh my God, he's a heretic. This is it. I knew it. Too good to be true. But then he mentioned you. I listened to the whole series. It's like 30 episodes. And it was really thought-provoking. So I know you've done a lot of work in this area. Can you kind of break down this idea of multiple gods in the Bible and what that actually means? I would love to hear that.
Yeah, a lot of this is going to be unfamiliar to your listeners, but there are going to be significant points that are quite familiar to your listeners. You know, for me, I'll just make it biographical. And this is the first chapter in Unseen Realm, my watershed event, where I'm a doctoral student at a really good Hebrew and Semitics program. I've taught 20 courses. I've taught 5 years. I'm not a newbie. I've got 2 master's degrees. And I'm sitting in church and in a discussion with another guy in the Hebrew department, and he just pulls his Hebrew Bible out, sticks it under my nose, and says, "You need to read Psalm 82, the first verse in Hebrew." And I did. It's Elohim, okay? Which again, we all kind of know what that term is. Elohim nitzav ba'adat el. So Elohim, God, stands or takes his stand in the divine council. You know, we know it's capital G-O-D because Nitzav is a singular participle. I'm sorry for the grammar spasm, but it's important here. Mm-hmm. So we've got capital G-O-D takes his stand in the midst of the divine in the divine council. And then the next line in the same verse, we have Elohim again, you know. But we have Bekerav Elohim Yishpot, in the midst of the gods. It has to be plural because you can't be in the midst of a singular entity. Mm-hmm. In the midst of the gods, he, the first one, passes judgment. And I looked at that and I thought, wow, that looks like a pantheon.
Right.
You know? Like, how in the world have I never encountered this before? I mean, I'm not a newbie. What in the world? And then if you keep reading, you get to verse 6, and the speaker, again, the first capital G-O-D says, "I said to all of you," plural, "you guys, you're all Elohim, all of you, sons, plural, of the Most High, but you're going to die like men."
It does not compute.
right. Like, what, you know, I don't remember a word of the sermon, right. But like this was my watershed event because I, and again, God providentially knew how to push this button and when to push it. You know, it eventually became the focus of my doctoral work. It's pretty much been the focus of everything, you know, the supernatural worldview of the Bible. But I had to make a decision at some point. Am I going to let the biblical text say what it says or not?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that wasn't an easy decision. I had my theology. I liked it. I was good at it. I had taught it. But, you know, I had to find an answer for this. And so, you know, the first thing I do, I'm going to go look at commentaries. Well, all the evangelical commentaries, you know, bless your pointed little head. Nothing to worry about here. The gods are men. They're Israelite judges. Mm. They're Israelites generally. They're elders. They're whatever. And I'm like, this is so lame, because I know when I go to Psalm 89 and I get the same counsel language with the same dudes, you know, sons of the Most High. There is only one Most High. That's the God of Israel. So it's sons of God.
Right.
If you go to Psalm 89, the sons of God in the council, and the council is in the skies. It's in the heavens. Mm-hmm. Well, the last time I looked, you know, looking around, there aren't a bunch of Jewish guys floating around in the skies or living in the skies, you know, that are doing what is described. And they're under judgment anyway. You know, it just doesn't make any sense.
Right.
But if I went to the critical, you know, scholars that have no theological confessions, oh, they love Psalm 82. Oh man, this is, they probably have Psalm 82 in their secular heathen devotions every day, you know? because it allows them to argue that the biblical writers were polytheists just like everybody else. And so fortunately, again, providentially, I thought, you know, as I'm encountering no help,
right,
like I'm alone here. And I got some decisions to make here, you know, about what in the world is going on here. Because I know a very bad argument when I see one. And that's what I'm getting in evangelical sources. It's indefensible, literally. So I, fortunately, by providence, I had another thought, and that was, I'll bet Jesus knew this verse. I'll bet Paul knew it. And somehow, the theology that the New Testament so clearly articulates didn't stumble over this. So there must be an answer. And it took me, probably close to a year to figure this out. And when it's one of those things, when you figure it out, you go, you're such an idiot, because it's like right there in front of your face, you know?
Yeah.
And it's what you have in Psalm 82.
Yeah.
This is a product of the biblical worldview. Okay. The biblical writers believe that the gods were real. Okay, that doesn't mean that they're polytheists, all right? Because the guys at Qumran are using this language 160 some times. And they're not liberals. Okay, they separated from the Pharisees, all right? They're not liberals.
Right.
And a lot of that stuff is in council scenes, you know. So let's slow down here. What could this possibly mean? Okay, it means that the gods are real in that they are real spiritual beings. Well, that's a familiar thought.
Right.
Because if we take the Bible seriously, we believe in an animated, populated spiritual world. That's the most obvious thing in the world. And so I had the thought, well, maybe Elohim is just like a neutral term.
Right.
Now the way you get there is you do something boring. Like you search for all the places in the Hebrew Bible where Elohim occurs. It's only like 2,300.
Okay.
Not that many.
Right.
No, a weekend.
If you took the Evelyn Wood speed reading course. there's a lot of them, but you go through them and you discover that the biblical writers, Hebrew Bible, use Elohim of five or six different things that are not the God of Israel. That tells you immediately that the word is not about a specific set of unique attributes. Out of the gate, it tells you that. And what the problem was in my head and what is in the modern head is that we are taught, because of Western culture and Western Christianity, that when you see the letters G, O, and D on a screen or on a piece of paper in a book, that we mentally default to, oh, G, O, and D together mean a unique set of specific attributes, things like omniscience, creator, you know, sovereignty, all this stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, if that's the case, that cannot be the case with Elohim, because the biblical writers are using Elohim of things that are clearly they define as lesser than the God of Israel. And so that was when the lights went on. It's like, okay, all Elohim, like 1 Samuel 28, the medium at Endor, when she conjures up Samuel for Saul. And, you know, she freaks out because whatever she does, we're not actually told what she does, but it like works, you know. And she freaked out and it reveals to her, like, I'm in trouble now because you're Saul. You know what I mean? Like, this was a trap. And he's like, don't worry, you're not going to die. You know, what does he look like? But she says, I see Elohim coming up out of the ground.
Mm.
And then Saul says, what does he look like? Well, he's wearing his cloak thing and his, you know, it's just a terrible color. You know, she describes him and he's like, this is the guy. And then when they have the conversation, and you know, it's Samuel because they're having conversations that they had before. And, you know, but it's like no Israelite would think that the deceased Samuel is on an attribute level par with the God of Israel.
Hmm.
Nobody is thinking that, or their dead baby, or their dead, you know, grandma. You know, well, they're both called Elohim, Mike. They have to be this. No, you idiot. You only think that way because you've been taught.
Yes.
To see the letters G O N D as equating to a set of attributes. That is not what the term means. All the term means is that you would use the term Elohim to describe or label something, some entity that lives in the spiritual world.
Hmm.
They are by nature the disembodied residents of the spiritual world. Hmm. It's actually a term like ruchot, spirits. It's a spiritual being. Hmm. Now, what that means is that in the biblical mindset, the spiritual world has lots of characters.
Hmm.
And one of the terms you can use of them is Elohim. Okay? Just like spirit.
Right.
It doesn't mean that they are equal to Yahweh of Israel. You know, what you have is that Yahweh is one of the Elohim that lives in the spiritual world. That's his address, okay? Mm-hmm. But none of those Elohim are him. And we know that's true, not because, well, that's what the Westminster Confession says, so I'm glad you got there, Mike. No, it's true because the biblical writers assign certain attributes only to Yahweh of Israel, and they specifically deny those attributes to all others.
Hmm.
So our theology is intact. Yahweh is species unique among the Elohim.
Mm-hmm.
But we can use Elohim to describe any of them because it just means they're a resident of the spiritual world. Problem solved. I mean, there it goes. This is why Jesus, and the other thing that just really rankled me was if you go to John chapter 10, I did a whole episode of my podcast on this because this always comes up. I think it's episode 109, where, you know, Jesus quotes Psalm 82 verse 6 in his debate, you know, with you know, some of the Jewish leaders. And John 10:30, he has said, I and my Father are one. Hmm. John 10:36 or so, he says, the Father is in me and I'm in the Father.
Mm.
These are two clear, you can't parse them any other way but to deity.
Mm.
All right? In the middle, he quotes Psalm 82:6 when the Jews get mad at him for saying, I and my Father are one. And if you think that Psalm 82 is about humans, then what you have Jesus doing is you have him backpedaling.
Mm. Right?
You have him stepping back from the claim. No, he's not. What he's doing is he's saying, hey, doesn't your own Bible say that there are more sons of God, you know, that are spiritual beings? Doesn't that category exist in your Bible? Sons of God who are spiritual beings, not men, but spiritual beings. And they're like, yeah. And then, but you take that nugget and juxtapose it with the other two. Jesus is claiming, well, I'm one of those. I'm really, you know, the Son of God, but I'm more than that.
Hmm.
Because I and my Father are one. Hmm. And the Father is in me and I'm in the Father. In other words, I am Lord of the council.
Hmm.
So you better basically shut your yap, okay, at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't back off from the defense of his own deity at all.
Hmm.
He goes to Psalm 82 to poke him in the eye with it.
Hmm.
You know, because they're not saying, well, we're all sons of God. You know, all the Jews, we're children of God. You know, Jesus isn't saying, you know, I realize you're picking up stones to stone me, dudes, but, it's like the Barney song. I love you, you love me. Like, it's like, we're all just one happy family here. We're all the children of God now. It's like Oprah. You know, Jesus does Oprah in John chapter 10. We're all children. No, that's not what he's saying.
Hmm.
He's using Psalm 82 to stick it to them.
Hmm.
Okay. I'll tell you, you know, who you're dealing with here. You know, we'll just see if you can figure it out.
Right.
You know, when I started to see things like this, it's like, you know, you go through an angry phase where why didn't anybody teach me this? Why did it take me so long? Not only to noodle this,
yeah,
but to even know it was there.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I'm just a millennial or, you know, a pastor somewhere and I'm out on the internet and I get plastered with Psalm 82 or somebody in my church brings this to me and I had no idea.
Right.
I mean, I give them all, they're just Israelites. Don't read Psalm 89. Just stop at Psalm 82. You know, it's like, what are we doing?
Right. Right. Yeah.
So the gods are real because the biblical writers thought they were real. You know, it took me to Deuteronomy 32:8, you know, with the Dead Sea Scroll readings there that some English translations now incorporate, thankfully.
Mm.
But that just opened the floodgates too with this, you know, the cosmic geography, the whole worldview, which is where Daniel gets his theology. Everybody knows Daniel, oh, Prince of Persia, Prince of Greece. Oh, this is so cool. Supernatural beings over geographical regions. This is all that nobody ever asks. Well, where did Daniel get that? Did like he just make that up?
Was it right?
No, he gets it from Deuteronomy 32:8. And if you understand that, then you know who the princes are. You know that when Paul dips into Daniel 10 for some of his vocabulary through the Septuagint, you know who the principalities and the powers are. They're the gods of the nations. They are the fallen gods. They are the defeated gods of the Old Testament. They're still here, and they still want the same thing, your destruction. Okay, they want to divorce you from Yahweh. That's what they want. You know, it's like this whole worldview. It bleeds into so many passages. And it has explanatory power for not only what's going on in a passage, but why the passage says what it says, how this passage connects to another passage. You know, I tell people all the time, look, you know, I'm not a charismatic. I mean, I have charismatic friends who love my content, you know, for obvious reasons.
I'm not a charismatic.
But a lot of them will say you're like the antidote to the wackiness. You know, thank you.
Yes.
You know, I'm happy to play that role, you know, but my, when people talk to me about interpreting scripture, look, the best interpretation of a passage is not the most supernatural one. Okay. Rather, the best interpretation of a passage is the one that not only works in the passage, but works everywhere else that passage is repurposed and used.
Right.
That's what you're looking for.
And
that's how you build out the matrix, you know, to borrow that, you know, metaphor.
So yeah.
That's what I'm trying to do in Unseen Realm and in the podcast. It's like, look, it's supposed to make sense.
Right.
The Bible, what a novel thought. It's supposed to make sense. Nothing in it is thrown away. There's not like, oh, I got to finish this book before midnight or I'm not going to pass the course.
Right.
Like everything is there to serve some larger purpose in the meta narrative, in the world.
Right.
It all has a role to play. And so that's what we've lost.
Right.
You don't ever have to run into me. You're still going to be able to understand the gospel. You know, you don't need Mike's books, Frito for Salvation. It just, you don't need any of that. But what you do need it for, and these other things like the Bible Project is, look, it's supposed to make sense. And what we're trying to do is show you how.
Right.
We're trying to show its coherence to you so that you'll learn how to approach scripture better. You'll learn kind of what questions should run through your head, how to connect dots, just the thought that maybe these dots should be connected. I mean, just that will take people a considerable distance down the road. And that's what we're after. That's what we're after. So, you know, the coherence of scripture, the coherence of the meta narrative, with an eye toward not abandoning the supernatural worldview,
right?
Or pretending that our modern materialistic context, our post-enlightenment rationalism, is the worldview of the biblical writers, because it's not.
Right. So let me ask you this, because I mean, that so much was said. It was phenomenal. I want to get a little specific on one part. So I've always understood this idea of, you know, the fall of, you know, like, I guess angels and demons. I always understood the hierarchy to be, or I was taught this, you have angels and then you have God and that's it. And then one day, you know, Lucifer, right. Yeah, exactly. And then one day Lucifer is like, I want your power, God. So he rebelled and took some angels and then became demons. And then that's who, you know, tempted Eve. And that's all we got. But you're saying that, no, the Bible has a lot more characters to fill out in the supernatural world, including this idea of gods who are overseeing like parts of creation. So how does the fall work with this?
Yeah, most of what you just said is correct, but it's quite incomplete. Some of it is incorrect. There's, you know, one or two points, but this is, your summary is really good because that's what you get in church tradition.
Yes.
White hats, black hats, real short list of characters.
Right.
What I'm saying is if you asked the average Christian, again, why the world is such a mess, what you just said is going to be the answer. Okay. Well, the fall and Satan, demons and, you know, fallen angels. And okay, there we go. If you ask the same question to a literate, you know, Israelite, you know, who had most of his Bible, or a first century Jew, who had, you know, the whole Bible. Mm. That is not the answer you would get to that question. Mm. And the answer you would get to the question is, well, there are actually three reasons why the world is such a chaotic mess. Mm. Now, the first of the three was what happened in Eden, which is typically, we're taught that's the only one to look at.
Right. That is the fall. Everything right. hinges
that's
on
the
that.
Fall. So we've got a supernatural rebellion. There's a supernatural being that rebels against God's authority and tries to trip up the humans, and then they rebel. And,
right.
you know, the result of that is really two major things. One is death. Okay, everything dies now. Eden is no more. We are divorced from the source of life, who is God, who had come to earth to dwell with us in his house called Eden and all that kind of stuff, okay? So we have death, and naturally with that, we have ultimately estrangement from God. So those are significant problems. But that's one of three. As you keep reading in Genesis, then you have Genesis 6:1-4. And this is the one we're taught to not see. Yeah.
I read this, I'm like, what just happened?
Right. We're taught to not see the sons of God. And even though that phrase everywhere else is used of you know, supernatural beings, you know, don't read that way here, because now we've got, you know, they're just men again. None of the traditions and none of the clues in the Hebrew Bible that link back to this passage say that. Zero. Nada. Okay, that is something that, you know, and this used to be the worldview of not only the Jewish community, because they can read their text and they know what the phrase means, all right? Mm. But also the early church up until, I mean, Augustine deserves most of the blame for this, but there was a guy before him, you know, Africanus, who rejected the supernatural reading of Genesis 6. And then Augustine just carried the load, and because he was Augustine, everybody followed him. Okay.
Right. Right.
So that's where the Sethite view comes from. But again, none of that makes coherent sense in light of what else the Bible does with that passage. Mm-hmm. You know, and I go through all the data, all the reasons, both in Unseen Realm and also in the Demons book, and in Reversing Hermon as well. But what you have is you have a supernatural rebellion again. The major impact of it is not the weird Nephilim, even though everybody loves them. You know, they're superhero, supervillain characters.
Right,
you
know? Right.
Okay, but that's not the big concern. The big concern is what the sons of God, these supernatural beings who come to earth, what they teach humans.
Hmm.
Because out of that comes depravity. Now, let me just back up a little bit. If you asked a first century Jew where demons come from, they're going to say, oh, it's Genesis 6. They're the disembodied, demons are the disembodied spirits of dead Nephilim. And you think, you're nuts. Like what, where did that come from? But there are pieces of it, and Dead Sea Scrolls agree on this. You know, intertestamental Second Temple Jewish literature agrees on it. I mean, right now you can buy whole doctoral, you know, published doctoral theses on this. You know, Archie Wright's book, The Origin of Evil Spirits, is great. Hmm. You know, every There, you guys know, in theology, it's really rare to get a unified tradition on anything.
Yes. Yes.
This is one of those.
Okay.
Everybody says the same thing.
Okay. That's important.
But we want to throw this one out. You know, like when because it's too weird.
It's too weird.
Okay. Well, you know, again, this is where all the traditions go. There are passages that have the Rephaim, who are descendants of the Nephilim, you know, the Anakim and all this stuff in Deuteronomy, in Sheol, in the underworld. So there's a connection between the disembodied spirits of these Rephaim rulers or kings or warriors being in, you know, in hell, essentially. Okay. And this is all Second Temple writers are doing. They're taking these nuggets and then they're building out from the data points, they're building out a systematized theology of the material. They're not making it up either. They're not insane. They're looking at their Hebrew Bible and connecting dots. That's all they're doing. But we just don't connect those dots. We don't want to go there because, again, it's too weird. It's just too bad that Peter, Second Peter, refers to the angels, plural, that sinned. Well, those are the third of the angels that fell with Satan, Mike.
Right.
Don't you know your Bible?
Right.
Yeah, I do. And I do. And it might shock you, but there isn't a single verse that ever says that. You can use a concordance if you look up the number three or third with the word, you know, angel. Zero occurrences until the book of Revelation, which is the last book of the Bible.
Right.
And even then, the war in heaven there breaks out in response to the birth of the Messiah. It is nothing. It's very, you know, pro tip. Okay. Interpretive pro tip. Jesus was born after the time of Adam and Eve. Okay? You know, the stuff that we use to explain away Genesis 6 is just nutty. That's what's nutty. Right? And I understand that it's weird. And I know people, maybe the biblical writers just sort of accepted this idea and they were just writing about it, but they weren't really committed to it or they knew better. You know, it's like, that's a nice try, but you know what? I'm going to put on my village atheist hat now and say, oh, you mean like the virgin birth? Oh, you mean like the incarnation or the Trinity or the hypostatic? You bet you didn't expect an atheist to know the term like the hypostatic union, did you? You know, in other words, what makes this one too weird to believe?
Right.
Against all these other ones.
Yep. Right.
Again, newsflash, nothing we believe conforms to a scientific, materialistic, post-enlightenment, rationalistic worldview. Zero. It all extends from a single idea. Is there a God or not? Because if there is, then we get to ask really simple questions. Well, if God exists, is he capable of creating beings like himself? Why wouldn't he be? Are those beings capable of doing things that he did, kind of like we can, because we're in the image of God and we have creative ability and power, and you know, we use our intellectual and our physical resources. Might they use their intellectual resources to do things that are beyond us, but they're exercising creativity? You know, could God not create beings that are capable of doing that like us, except we're embodied and they're not? Is there a verse that says that they can't become embodied at will? No. So maybe God left that on the table. Is that possible? I mean, these are really simple questions.
Right.
They all extend from the question of theism, which, again, theologians and unbelievers have demonstrated that is a coherent proposition. They have demonstrated this for millennia. It is on sure footing. It cannot be overturned. So if you're going to accept the idea that there is a God and that God actually can do things and acts with intention, he's got a brain, so to speak, okay? Then all of this stuff is on equal footing. All of these ideas, because they extend from theism, they're not things to be believed because science can validate them. Science can't validate all the points of our faith. It's beyond science. So can we just own that? But anyway, in the story, these beings who are in rebellion, they not only come and produce the Nephilim, but they teach humans terrible things that proliferate depravity, lead to self-destruction. Why do Peter and Jude, when they talk about false teachers, why do they bring up the, you know, angels? Because they know their Old Testament. Like they know that these two ideas go together. False teaching, supernatural rivals. Okay. Where do we get terms like evil spirits, unclean spirits in the Gospels? Well, if you go back in Second Temple literature, these are the terms, especially unclean spirits. This is the terminology used to reference the disembodied spirits of the Nephilim. Because how does the Torah define uncleanness? Icky? No. It's a thing that results from or reflects two things that don't belong together. An impure mixture. This is the logic behind unclean spirits. And it points right back to Genesis 6. It's why the Dead Sea Scrolls call them bastard spirits, because that's what they are. I mean, the language makes sense on its own terms, but that's only rebellion number two. Rebellion number three,
okay.
I mean, as if things aren't bad enough.
We're depraved here. How worse can they get?
Well, this is why Genesis, here's another one. Has anybody in the audience ever asked themselves this question? Well, I read Genesis 6, 1 through 4, sons of God, Nephilim, and all that weird stuff. And then you look at verse 5, and God saw, you know, the wickedness of mankind upon the earth, that every thought of the imagination of his heart was only evil continually. How do the first four verses get to verse 5? Well, if you know the backstory, and again, I spent a lot of time on the backstory, the Mesopotamian antecedents to this, and just the whole logic of false teaching and the depravity, it makes perfect sense. If you think they're just men, they're, I don't know what Peter's doing talking about angels that sinned. I guess he just had a bad day or something. Right. You know, he hadn't read Augustine. You know,
something in his tea or something. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you. God sends the flood, and you know, this is part of the response, part of the flood. And so it's hit the reset button. God doesn't give up on his original plan. He's not going to destroy everything, but he's going to save a remnant. And then he repeats the Edenic command to Noah and his kids, like just to telegraph, okay, we're going to kickstart Eden again. Just, you know, you guys ought to know this language by now.
Right.
And so, you know, be fruitful, multiply, spread over the earth, you know. And so Genesis 11 has this great line in it where the people get together and they say, let's build a tower, lest we go out and obey what God has told us to do. Yeah. Lest we go out from this place. You know, it's like, you know,
right.
Like exactly what you're supposed to do, they don't do. And so they build this tower. Now, we know the story, and you'd say, well, I don't see any supernatural beings in Genesis 11. You're right. You're right. You only see them if you get to Deuteronomy 32. Because in Deuteronomy 32:8, I'll just use the ESV here, because the ESV actually uses the Dead Sea Scrolls, which hint, you know, might be a good idea. When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, okay, when we know the nations become what they are as a result of the flood, because we have Genesis 10 right after Genesis 9, and right. You get the whole list of nations. And all right. When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, again, we know when that happened, that's the whole Babel thing after the flood, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. Ooh, there's that phrase again. Ouch.
Right.
Or those Israelite elders before the laws of Israel are really busy.
Right.
Okay. Now, a lot of your translations will say he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel or something like that. There is no Israel. At the time of Babel, go read Genesis 10 for all the nations. There is no Israel. Israel happens after Babel when Abraham is called. That's its beginning.
Chapter 11.
Chapter 11. What a coincidence. You know,
it's like there's a story at work here, and it's like unfolding.
You know, but what happens is what essentially, you know, to cut to the chase here, verse 9 is really important. So he fixes the nations, their borders, and their inheritance according to the number of the sons of God. But the Lord's portion, Yahweh's portion, is his people. Jacob is his allotted inheritance. So, you know, this is looking back on how the nations are one thing and then Israel is something unique. because in the flow of the story, Israel gets created after, you know, the Babel event. And it, this allotment language is important. So what you essentially have is, I refer to the Babel event as the Romans 1 event of the Old Testament, where God says, I've had it. I can't believe these people are rebelling again. Not only are they not dispersing, but they're building this tower. What's the tower? I mean, everybody agrees it's a ziggurat. Well, why would you build one of these? Well, if you know something about ziggurats, they're part of temple complexes. Why do you build temples? To locate the deity to where you are.
Right.
And God says, no. Well, this is not what I just told you to do. I am not to be tamed. I am not at your beck and call. I've had it. And so God divorces humanity. He disinherits them. You're done. We're done. We are done. Relationship severed. I'm going to assign each of you to other members of the heavenly host. I'm going to give you what you, apparently you don't want me to be your God. So I'm going to put placeholders in here. Now, I don't think that they were evil to begin with. I think they are put in the, in these charges, and it just, it doesn't take too long before it basically goes to hell in a handbasket. Because if you read through Deuteronomy, you know, Deuteronomy 4, 19 and 20, God allots the nations to these gods and the gods to the nations. These turn out Deuteronomy 17, Deuteronomy 29, Deuteronomy 32, 17, they seduce the Israelites into worshiping them instead of Yahweh. Psalm 82, you know, you have at the very end of the Psalm when God says, hey, all of you are Elohim, sons of the Most High, but you're going to die like men. You're going to fall like any prince. And then you get to the last verse and the psalmist, you know, exclaims, rise up, O Lord, you know, God, take back the nations. Okay, it's a judgment. God is going to punish the host of heaven in the heavens, in the spiritual world, Isaiah 34, you get Isaiah 24. But this is where Daniel gets his theology that the nations around Israel are governed by other supernatural entities. This is why Paul, who occasionally uses the word demon, can, and he does so because of the influence of the Septuagint. I cover all this in chapter 2 in my demons book. But most of the time, Paul refers to the powers of darkness as principalities, powers, rulers, thrones, dominions. What do they all have in common? They are terms of geographical dominion. So this is a third group. So we've got Satan, the Satan figure that emerges in the wake of the fall story. We've got the depravity problem with Genesis 6. Again, all the traditions have the offending sons of God sent to the abyss, you know, locked up in hell until the time of the end, okay? But then you've got the Nephilim. They're a residual problem, but they get killed off. But then other disembodied spirits get to be demons that seek re-embodiment and torment us. Plus, they taught us terrible things that led to our self-destruction and depravity. So we're a mess. And now we get to be fragmented from each other. Now we get to be divorced from the true God and under the dominion of powers, a la Psalm 82, that seek to sow chaos among us. What a mess.
Yeah.
Okay, what a mess. And the thing is, the neat thing, if you can say a neat thing about all this, is that if you believe these three stopping points, three rebellions instead of one, you expect the Messiah to fix all three. Mm-hmm. Not just one. And this is why I wrote Reversing Hermon, but you know, I covered it in the Demons book as well. And the way Jesus is presented in places, in passages, in conversations, the coming of the Lord and his work on the cross and the resurrection and the ascension, all of it, address all three points in any given passage. It reverses everything. It's not just I'm the cure for death. It's not just about everlasting life. It's about being a cure for depravity. When I go, the Spirit's going to come. The Spirit, the Lord of the Spirit, all this kind of talk in the New Testament.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen unless he ascends. Okay, the new covenant doesn't happen unless he ascends. You know, all of this kind of stuff that I'm going to put my law in your heart and, you know, the Spirit's indwelling, all this stuff. And then, you know, the whole healing of the nations theme. I mean, how many times do you see that in the New Testament?
Yeah.
Where the Gentiles are referred to as the people of God. They are brought back into relationship. I mean, the work of Christ addresses all three rebellions.
Wow.
It is a coherent story. It is a coherent biblical theological picture that when if you get the framework, you will begin to see how the points of the framework just, you know, drip into all sorts of passages in both Testaments.
Wow.
And you know what? That's the way it's supposed to be. That's the way under providence that the thing was written.
Hmm.
It's not random. It's intelligent. It's purposeful. Hmm. Everything contributes something to the whole. You know, and I'm not one of these that says, well, every passage in the Bible is about Jesus. No, the menstrual laws really aren't. The law is about where you put poop. You know, that's really not about Jesus. But it does teach sacred geography from profane geography.
Mm-hmm.
It does teach that blood is the source of life. And who gave the blood? Why are Israelites forbidden from eating, consuming the blood? Because it's not theirs. It comes from the life source. It goes back to God.
Mm.
And you bury it so that other gods don't get it.
Mm.
Okay? You waste it on the ground. You know, all of this is a coherent worldview that intertwines what's going on earth while things are going on in the heavenlies.
Hmm.
There's relationships and rivalries and conflicts in both spheres, and they operate in tandem. You know, the whole as in heaven, so on earth. I mean, it's a very short way to describe a very large concept with lots of facets to it.
Yeah.
But this is what the Bible is.
Hmm.
Okay. And so what I try to do, what Tim is trying to do, you know, and others, you know, is we are trying to build the matrix for you so that you can have the framework in your head and now just go to town. Like re-experience the thrill of discovering the stuff that's in your Bible.
Yeah.
Because now you have some place to put the data points.
Yeah.
You have a means by which to think about their interconnectivity.
Wow. Yeah.
It's not just memorize this verse or this cold verse. I'm not against memorization. I mean, you know, but you know what I mean? It's Bible memorization is not Bible study. I'm sorry to say that, but it's true.
Mm.
There's a lot to think about. There's a lot to marvel at. To me, the best defense of, you know, the sort of the abiding interest of God is the Bible, because there's no way it could have just emerged.
Right.
it takes God's interest for a very long period of time with lots of hands of people that will never know their name.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But the end result is like, yeah, there it is. And it's wonderfully coherent, and it tells us the truth about ourselves, about what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
About what reality really is. Yeah. You know, it's just, to me, it's a thing of wonder. So I didn't lose my faith over it. I'm, you know, I could have been really damaged if I'd have said, oh, they're just men and I'm not going to read Psalm 89. Closed my eyes. You know, why are your eyes closed, Dad, when you read the Bible? Oh, it's Psalm 89. I'm past it now. You know,
One thing I enjoy that you wrote in Unseen Realm is kind of looking at the supernatural realm as a prototype or a template for what God was doing in the human realm.
Oh gosh. Yeah. I mean, when that hit me, it's like, this is just too cool. You know, because that is a contention of the book that, all right, I'm not, maybe you guys have heard me say this before. It is not an exaggeration. I'm not lying. I wish I could even say I was shading the truth, but I'm not. This is the tragic truth. Until my Psalm 82 event, when I was in grad school at Wisconsin, until that providential rattling of my cage, okay, I had been through Bible college. I had been through seminary. I had, you know, been through, you know, a couple of years of grad school. I had taught for 5 years. I had literally in like the first, I don't know, 10 years of my schooling, whatever it was, I literally had one clock hour, not credit hour, clock hour, 60 minutes of instruction on angels and demons.
Right.
Wow.
Now, if you go through that, you are immediately left with the impression that this stuff cannot be important. Hmm. Otherwise, they'd spend more time on it.
Right.
But what I've come to realize is that the more we know about God's, the way God looks at the spiritual world and his family and those who have rebelled against him in the spiritual world, the way they are talked about and described and tasked and their status, those things are templates. They are starting points for all of the vocabulary for how God describes us.
Hmm.
And that is intentional, because if you go back to Eden, God already has a family. He already Right. has a supernatural family. He comes to earth with that family. This is why there's plurals in Genesis 1:26. It's not the Trinity. Mm. There's lots of technical Right. reasons, you know, why this is the case. And I go through that in Unseen Realm.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Lots of academic, you know, reasons. Yeah. But God wants a new family of embodied creatures that he's going to call humans, okay? Adam. Mm. And he wants to be with them and they with him, with his other family. And there's supposed to be this symbiotic relationship where God comes to earth and dwells with these new people. And they all coexist and get along and enjoy the creation and the partnerships that he has with them. But them in the spiritual world, humans in the terrestrial world.
Hmm.
But it's supposed to be, there's supposed to be this point of intersection, this spiritual and physical utopia. Okay, that's what it's supposed to be. And not coincidentally, if you peek at the end of the book of Revelation, that's what it is.
Hmm.
Heaven returns to earth.
Right.
That's not an accident. Hmm. And along the way, God speaks about relationships and the status of humans in ways that he describes these other guys too. I think that one of the neatest examples is in the Old Testament, holy ones is overwhelmingly used of supernatural beings, members of the heavenly host. Mm. There are a couple of times where it's also humans, which incidentally is it's in the later text as well.
Mm.
But in the New Testament, Hagioi, holy ones, is never used of the supernatural members of the heavenly host. It's used only of human believers.
Hmm.
Might there be a reason for that?
Huh.
Yeah, it is, because we're grafted back into the family.
Right. Right.
We are. We're wow. not only going to occupy sacred space, we are space, because the Spirit indwells us. Mm-hmm. God lives in us now. We are the temple. You know, all the temple talk of the New Testament.
Yeah.
I believe. I mean, there are just things like this that there are threads to trace across the Testaments that really tie together the supernatural world and the human world in very specific ways. That if you're dismissive of that either intentionally or in my case, I never knew.
Right.
I mean, nobody ever showed me. And I'm not going to go look, because if it was important, I would have gotten more than 60 minutes.
Right, right, right.
Why should I waste my time?
Right.
You know,
do you have time for just one more question before we let you go? Go ahead, Rob.
So one of the questions that I've been thinking about is, you know, overlapping of the two views and the two realms is, why then is salvation only offered to the human realm and not to the supernatural realm? So Jesus came as a human to die and fix those three rebellions that we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that salvation only offered to the humans and not to the rebellious spirits or the unclean spirits or any of the fallen?
The simple but unsatisfying answer to that is that the Bible is primarily our story.
Right.
And so we're the focus. You know, the more honest answer is, I don't really know why God made that decision, but it's very evident that he did.
Right. Mm.
So there must have been, you know, all we can do is speculate. What is there about these weaker, lesser creatures, you know, in this place that God creates just so that they have a place to live because they're embodied, because they can't like live, you know, the spiritual world.
Right.
You know, what is it about them that is somehow you know, qualitatively different? You know, I don't think we're given a clear answer to that. I think, you know, we do get certain trajectories, you know, to think about when it comes to that. There's, again, we're not given a chronology here, but my sense is
sure
that the experiment was over almost as soon as it got started. So there may be a lingering sense of, I not only have to redeem this so that it isn't a failure. And again, God knew what was going to happen. Again, God is prepared for beings that he created, like, who are like him, one property of which is free will. He's prepared for them to use it and just go astray, because newsflash, they aren't him. They're like him, but they're not him.
Right.
So even before the whole thing gets going, God knows what's going to become necessary if they fail. He's going to have to always take the initiative to redeem this. He's going to enter into covenants. The covenants are with people. So you can't change the parameters of the covenants and cheat and say, well, they're not with people anymore. It's just between you and me. No. So God's going to have to become a man, which is, you know, where we get this, you know, in Hebrews 10, this conversation within the members of the Trinity. You know, God knows all this. Okay. So out of the gate, he has taken plans to make sure this isn't a failure. You know, you could appeal to the chronology and say, well, it was kind of over before it started. And so maybe God's like, you know, I need to do this because I want it to work. And so I'm not only going to do that, but I'm going to vent my wrath against the ones who tried to ruin this for me. I think that's probably a better trajectory than the first part of it. But nevertheless, we're not specifically told that. In other words, the humans rebel because they're deceived.
Right.
You know, initially. I mean, they have more high-handed rebellion later on with idolatry and whatnot. But the other rebellion involved no deception. It was a high-handed effort to displace God. And so I can speculate that God took that with more offense than the other. I mean, maybe that's the answer. I don't know.
Right.
We're not told, but it's very evident that he makes this choice.
Right.
This is the way that the whole series, the whole, you know, story is presented to us.
Yeah. So you've really given us, I mean, I can tell that you've given us the 10,000 foot view and we can see the surface, but we're not even close to even touching it, let alone going deep.
Well, this is why
I appreciate it.
Right. We, you know, it's like, well, I could do 100 hours of podcast to write a book.
Exactly. Yeah. I honestly get it, because especially to us, you know, Western post enlightenment readers, this is very foreign. Even in our own faith, it's foreign to us, you know? So, you know,
let me close with the metaphor for people who are, they've probably been uncomfortable for the last 45 minutes. So, you know, another thing I tell people is, look, And I hope they'll look at my resume to know that I'm not just saying this, but look, I'm your friend. Okay. Right. I'm your friend. What I'm going to ask you to do in a book like Unseen Realm. And again, that's an academic book. It has lots of footnotes, but it's got like almost 3,000 reviews on Amazon. Mostly 99% are by lay people. Okay. I had a good editor. You know, it's very readable. So don't be scared by books with footnotes. I did write Supernatural, which is just the core ideas of Unseen Realm. So that's there for those people too. But, you know, you look at all this and I lost my train of thought here. I'm trying to pick it up again. What were you saying?
Well, what I was saying was, I was going to ask you, how do we get these kinds of stories out more, because it just seems like our evangelical culture has a very particular narrative that doesn't include this.
I got my trajectory now.
Perfect. So
the short answer is if you're a pastor or a teacher, you have to be able to start with things that are familiar to your audience. You know, talk to them about the stuff in the book about imaging. Because it really matters whether we have a defensible view of the image of God or not. You know, ethics, not only theology, but ethics. You know, start with the two Yahwehs idea in the Old Testament, that there's a transcendent Yahweh, and there's God come as a man. Sometimes they're in the same scene. That's a backdrop for how Jews could accept the idea of Jesus being God as well as the God of heaven. It has very deep Old Testament roots. So start with something familiar. And here was my trajectory. I tell people, look, I'm your friend. And I know this is going to be a bumpy ride at places. So what I'm asking you to do is I'm asking you to get in the car. And I'm going to tell you, I know how to take you from point A to point B. I've been to point B many times. We'll get there. You're going to get there safe and sound. And so you get in the car and we start driving and you look out the window and nothing looks the same. And you start getting freaked out. like who's this crazy man behind the wheel?
Right. What happened?
And it's like, look, you got to trust me. I'm a normal, dare I say, even boring Trinitarian, evangelical, conservative, theological kind of guy, you know. If you're charismatic, I'm not gonna nag you about that. Or I mean, you're not in my crosshairs.
Right.
If you're
not
charismatic, you probably feel better already. You know. So, I'm none of these things. They don't matter. You know, what matters to me are the core ideas, and I'm with you all. I can sign your doctrinal statements. You know, all these confessions. But I'm gonna be honest with you and say the way I get to those conclusions may be dramatically different. And along the way, if you have an argument in defense of one of those things that we both believe, but I know your argument stinks, I'm going to burn it in front of your eyes. Okay. So I'm just preparing you now. And you have to realize I'm doing you a favor because I'm going to replace it with something better. It's better to encounter me, your friend, doing this than if you go off to university or college. And you get the professor that can't wait to get to class to get his hands on a few Christians.
Right.
Because they'll burn your arguments in front of your eyes and never replace them.
Right. Right.
They'll just let you cry and fear.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
That's what they'll do. I know those people. I've been in some of those environments. They're there. Okay. So I'm asking people to trust me. And this is why I do interviews. You know, it's like, I understand, but I'm going to try to help you do better and think better. And when you get to the other side and you realize, wow, now everything looks familiar. You know, my theology is here. It's safe. Even though I don't really, you know, necessarily, I still wonder about how I got here. Right. I'm here. But now that I'm here, the roadmap, which is the Bible, is just so much more amazing.
Yes.
Than I thought it was.
And some of those gaps that we had before are now filled.
Some of those gaps are filled. I took detours that were awesome.
Yeah.
It took more time, but man, I'm glad I took that detour.
Yeah.
You know, this is what, again, and I can say this not, I mean, I'm not, when I worked at Logos, they intentionally kept me out of marketing.
I wonder why. I'm going to burn your idea in front of your eyes.
We had a few interesting meetings like that. Like, no, you can't say that. It's the truth. No, you can't.
A man from my own heart.
Find a different way. I'm not telling your audience like to sell books, even though that's important, you know, because I get to write other books.
Yes, yes.
But I'm telling them this because all of that happened to me. I lived all of it. I understand the trepidation.
Yeah.
I understand the uncertainty of it. Okay. I get it. But just stick with it. Dip your toe in. And if you're a leader, find places to build bridges to things that your people already hold dear, and then start, you know, navigating some of this other stuff that contributes to those important things. And you know, spark their imagination a little bit.
Right.
You know, put some fascination back, you know, in scripture. It shouldn't be hard because there's plenty in there that's just, you know, begging to be discovered. Yeah. So I would approach it that way.
Great. Well, listen, on that note, we are going to let you go. I appreciate you making the time. And like you said, I really believe that people like you and all the others out there, you're adding so much life and color to the Bible. And you're adding so many, you know, my analogy is always music because I'm a musician. You're adding more music tracks to the song, you know, like you're adding a vocal track and a choir track. And it's like, whoa, this song is so much more complex than what I've been maybe led to believe originally. So you're not changing the song, you're just filling it out. And the work that you guys do is, I mean, if we can encourage you, just keep going because we are listening and we are into it and we want to know more. So thank you for the time and thank you for the work that you do.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Absolutely. I'm recording this literally 30 seconds after Dr. Michael Heiser came on our show and blew our minds. And Rob, bring up what you said again. I want to hear it. It was so true.
So when Dr. Heiser, when Mike was saying, you know, we all go through kind of the angry phase, I wanted to just stop him right there and be like, okay, can you give us step-by-step instructions for us and specifically for Tim on how to get out of that phase?
Dude, in my mind, I didn't want to interrupt his train of thought, but I was like, ooh, that's me. That's me. And then when he also said, he goes, I will take your belief and I will burn it in front of your eyes. I'm like, I love you so much, Mike. Like you're so, yeah, that's maybe, I think for me, this was perhaps our most down to earth interview with someone who has the acumen of someone like a Michael Heiser, because you know, he was pretty humble in the interview, but this guy is the real, real deal. In fact, when I emailed him to come on the show, he has an automated response that's almost four paragraphs. Like, okay, if you're reaching out for this, please go here. If you're reaching out for this, please go here. No, I can't respond to general questions. Like, the guy is not only in demand, and he said it on the interview, his podcast has over 1 million downloads. Like, this guy knows his stuff. But he talks so plainly and so just, you know, he would just say things that like are kind of out of character for the idea you have of a scholar. And I love that because we talked about this before, Rob. The work of the scholars is the most underappreciated and unrecognized work in the evangelical church. I really believe that. They are doing work that is so key. It's so key to our faith, and no one knows about them. Most people don't know about Michael Heiser or about Tim Mackey or John Wallen or whoever else, you know? But these guys, what they're discovering about the Bible is essential to pushing the faith forward, especially for so many millennials and Gen Z, to saving the faith, to know it's not just about random verses or just random stories, but it's a unified story that is deeper and wider than we're ever going to know in one lifetime. That's amazing.
Yeah, I know. I didn't bring it up in the interview. I didn't want to waste the time, but he had when he was kind of going through all of this, him and his wife started going to a new church. I think he talks about this in Unseen Realm. And they were going to the church. He's like, you know, it was really good. The pastor was really good. He was going through a series on First Peter, and I was like really vibing with it. And then he got to the one section that he talked about in the podcast where they bring up kind of the stranger things of the Old Testament and the Nephilim and all that. And he's like, to my astonishment, the pastor just says, this is a little weird, so we're just going to skip it. He's like, we never went back.
Well, could you imagine? I mean, so I'm not sure what church he goes to now, but imagine being that pastor, knowing that you have Michael Heiser in your congregation. I would just be like, humana, humana, humana. I think this is right, but could be totally wrong. You know, like,
so if anyone in the audience can stand up and correct me.
Now's the time. Do I have anyone? Is there anyone here? I mean, I would be a nervous wreck because you can tell by the way he talked. He knows the Bible. I mean, dude, you know, quick caveat, I'm going to say this I haven't recorded the intro yet, but I'm going to say in the intro, I recommend having your Bible out and going to what he's talking about because he just assumes like, oh, you know, Genesis 6, we all know that story, right? And I'm like, yeah, Mike, we all know that story, knowing that like I just read it this morning in preparation for this interview and that the chances of our listeners driving right now listening to this are like, what is Genesis 6? And I appreciate that because it just shows how well he knows the content, you know, to the point where even his level of default is already head and shoulders above, I mean, most people who are listening to this episode, including myself.
Right. Most people on the episode.
Well, I don't want to put it like that, Rob, but, oh, man. Yeah, no, that was a great interview. And guys like that make me just want to know more. I want to get his books. I want to read more. I appreciate this understanding of like guys, the Bible talks about things that are supernatural, and that's not going to fit into our worldview, and that's okay. But what we cannot do is take our worldview and put it on the Bible and ignore what the Bible's trying to say around this stuff. That's what we can't do. I think a lot of people in our evangelical culture have done that. And listen, we talked about this before. I'm guilty of that as well. But the goal is to get rid of those lenses as much as possible, to let the biblical authors speak on their own terms and not us putting our terms on the Bible.
And as we get people like Michael Heiser on, and we get to get glimpses into these, he even said it himself, it's not that I'm changing the gospel, I'm not changing right. the message of Jesus or what the cross means,
right.
but it adds a level of depth to it, where that level of depth doesn't just stay at the cross, it then goes into the epistles, it goes backwards to the Old Testament, and you get a more in-depth understanding
yes.
of the meta story, the whole
yes.
story.
Yes.
And now, when somebody comes up and starts to question, well, didn't you know your Bible says in Genesis 6 that right. angels or sons of God, these spiritual beings, had sex with women? Isn't that weird? Yeah, it is weird, but it's important, and this is why.
Yes.
And this is the story that you can...
Yes.
That's addressed in the Bible.
I mean, dude, I didn't think about there being three falls in the Genesis narrative. You know, right. So the idea is, it's not that we're changing it, you're just adding 3D to it. Mm-hmm. You're not flattening out anymore, right? So even the death of Jesus, it's not just about so individual Tim can have his sins forgiven. Yes, that is a big part of it, but there's a much bigger story underneath of that that puts me into a bigger story than just me and Jesus, right?
Right.
So I agree with you, Rob. It's to be very clear, it's not that we're or it's not that people like Mike or anyone else who've had on are trying to change the gospel. They are simply filling it out for us. They're filling out the story. They're filling out the layers. They're adding new, they're unmuting those hidden tracks, you know, in our song that we never knew were there. And when they are unmuted, they add more context and richness to what we've already known. That's the whole point.
Yeah, it almost takes away the hard verses of the Bible. Because you're like, oh, now I have a framework to actually
yeah.
put this verse in or put this story in.
Totally, totally. Oh man, yeah, that was a good one. I'm happy with that interview. I can't wait till this airs. Whenever we're going to do it, but this was a good interview.
Yeah, I was trying to think of some of the other things. I have always wondered about, you know, that the spiritual realm, why there was no salvation for them. But I didn't want to take up more of his time. But I was thinking, on a personal level, you know, these spiritual beings already were in the presence of God, in his divine family.
Right.
And so they chose to leave the divine family, where I appreciate what he said about Adam and Eve and their partaking of the fruit
right.
was really a deception on
right.
their part. So there was already rebellious creatures that were deceiving them into leaving, you know, Yahweh,
yes.
the Holy One. So it would make sense. Okay, I'm going to offer salvation for those that were deceived. But for those that were, and it's almost ties into Romans 9, right?
Or yes.
Where
yes.
those that were not deceived but willingly turned away, there is no more salvation. Because it's almost that same thing. They've tasted of the gift. They've tasted of the divine family, as it were, and they've yes. willingly turned away from it.
There were a couple of things where I listen, obviously I didn't want to interrupt too much because
yeah,
you have
exactly.
to just wind them up and let them go, right? Like
yep.
we're here to hear him, not to hear us.
Insert quarter, go.
But yeah, right. But there were a few points where I'm like, ooh, like that kind of flies in the face of like ultra reformed theology, especially the one about like the that humans were deceived and this idea of like, not that it wasn't all our fault, but that it's kind of not all of our fault, because that flies in the face of you are wicked, you're depraved, you just hate, you know, that whole idea. There's a whole segment of Christianity out there that pretty much says like humans are the scum of the earth or the worst things ever. And we are willingly, you know, running from God all the time. And while there are definitely elements and stories you read in the Bible,
yeah.
well, that is true. Like Jonah, for example, that isn't like the theme of what is happening with the fall story, you know? And I was like, interesting. I'm not going to poke that bear here, but it made me kind of think back to some of that.
Yeah. And it was Hebrews that I was thinking of as I'm.
Yeah. I thought Romans 9, you're talking about Calvinism, and you know, I'm like, go ahead, Rob, go for it. But
which he also said some things that would fly in the face of that as well, of, you know, humans were designed like God with a free will.
Oh, don't say it, Rob. Well, Rob, we know that our good Calvinist friends who we respect would say that we do have a free will to only sin. That's our free will. We can only do evil. That's our will. So anyway, different discussion. But hey, everyone, thanks so much for tuning into this episode. All right, friends. Hey, it's Tim now in real time. I had to add on that 10-minute like post-conversation with Rob and I. It's listening back is just, I think you, I wanted you all to hear it because I really enjoy Rob and I loved that podcast that we were running together. So I hope you enjoyed that in the moment processing together and just having a good time. So, all right. Hey, listen, thanks for hanging in there. I know this was a longer episode than usual, but really this stuff is so deep and complex. You know, whenever I get a guy like Dr. Heiser on the show, or someone who just knows so much about the Bible, I try and sit and absorb it, because these guys, they have sat with these texts for years and years and know them inside and out. And I think it's a good reminder to all of us that the Bible is way more complex, way more nuanced, and in a lot of ways, way different than the evangelical culture has led us to believe. So, all right, I'm going to stop talking now. You've been listening to me for over an hour and a half. Thanks for checking out this episode. I will talk to you all next time.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.